Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Hello, Ilona Thompson with Palate Exposure. I'm here with David Newland, who specializes in executive recruiting searches in the wine country. Really fascinating vocation, and we'll get to know him a little bit. Where were you born, David?
So I was born in San Antonio, Texas.
Wow.
That's why I've got my cowboy boots on today.
I noticed that. I was wondering. So grew up there? Or?
No, you know, it's a funny thing. My dad was in the Air Force, so he retired, and we left Texas when I was three. In fact, we were leaving on the day that JFK got shot, and that's the only memory I have to this day of life in Texas. So from there, we moved directly to Santa Cruz, California, and that's where I grew up, was in Santa Cruz.
Santa Cruz. Yeah. Again, Texas, you know, most people think it's a very different flavor from Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
But you were very little, so your reference point is probably more towards the... What was it like growing up in Santa Cruz?
You know, Santa Cruz at that point, this is back in the 60s and 70s, was kind of like an island. There was only a two-lane highway going back and forth between San Jose and Santa Cruz. And so I remember when I went off to college, I got to college at UC Santa Barbara, and I realized, wow, I have really led a sheltered life. I had no idea how big the real world really was out there. And it was just a real shock that took me an entire year to kind of get caught up with, just emotionally and, I don't know, kind of intellectually, just really ready for what college life was going to be like. I didn't feel like Santa Cruz really prepared me for it, because it's such a low-key kind of hangout town back then. Now, today it's a lot more progressive, but back then it was a pretty low-key, isolated place to grow up.
Just kind of a surfer dude paradise?
It was, but the truth is I never became a surfer dude. You know, I wasn't particularly fond of swimming in the ocean. I had a bunch of friends who were surfer dudes and body surfers and boogie boarders and all that. But my thing in high school was I played a lot of beach volleyball. So I did enjoy the, you know, the life there. But ultimately, I felt like I needed to get away from Santa Cruz.
Okay, so what happened next? You went to school?
So, yeah, I started in UC Santa Barbara. I had a girlfriend who was still up in high school. Mm-hmm. I went to high school at Soka High. And I decided that I wanted to be closer to Santa Cruz in my sophomore year, so I pursued transferring up to UC Berkeley, because her mom and stepdad lived in UC Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And so I did get accepted at UC Berkeley. However, when I came back from the first year of college, my summer year, she broke up with me, kind of a thing. So I ended up going to UC Berkeley, did very well. I studied mechanical engineering, did very well in my sophomore year. I won a scholarship. I was representing one representative from the 30 top universities around the country. We all went to Flint, Michigan, and worked for General Motors for the summer as interns. So I was the UC Berkeley representative for mechanical engineering. And it was a real eye-opener again, where I realized, you know what, this is not my tribe. I don't really see myself being an engineer for the rest of my life. I worked with people who are 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years into their career, and I just could get it that this is not the path that I want to be on. So when I came back for the beginning of my junior year, I wanted to transfer into the finance program, because a couple of my college roommates there for the summer in Flint, Michigan, they were finance majors, and they had some really fascinating projects they were working on. I was kind of bored with the project I was working on. But at the time, Berkeley didn't have a finance program. They had an econ program, but I wanted to go straight for finance. So I dropped out of Berkeley as a kind of a midterm junior, went back to a junior college in Santa Cruz to get my GEs that were required to transfer into the finance program, and I transferred into San Jose State as an upper division transfer. And my very first course there, I had a professor named Lynn Morris, who was a PhD in mathematics, master's in economics, and he had been the first non-founding partner of a kind of a management consulting firm in San Francisco that had pioneered a breakthrough approach to strategic planning. It was called value-based strategic planning. Okay. He had left that profession to come to teach and kind of regroup in his life. I think he had gotten divorced, you know, just before that. So anyway, when I came in, I was so ready for a finance program that I just killed the first class, just absolutely smoked it. And so at the end of the first class, he asked if I was interested in becoming his teaching assistant. And so for the next few semesters until I finished, I was his teaching assistant. And then that got extended to also becoming a teaching assistant for his executive MBA program, because for some reason I just got finance. So he got a special dispensation from the dean of the business school that allowed me to become a teaching assistant for the executive MBA program, even though I hadn't yet finished my undergrad program. And then he started pulling me in on some of his consulting projects. And then when I graduated, he offered me a full-time job. And so the two of us worked together in management consulting, focused on corporate strategy, corporate finance, valuing privately held companies, things like that, for 7 or 8 years. And then I realized I was behind the computer working on Excel models so much, but the truth is I'm more of an extrovert. So I decided it was time to kind of step out of the shadow of my mentor and pursue a career in something new, but I didn't know what that was going to be. I have a cousin named Linda who had a executive search firm down in Santa Barbara, and she used the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator as part of her process. So she offered to profile me with the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator, which I did, and she was going to offer sort of career coaching advice to help me figure out what direction I might want to go in. And so when she saw my results, she said, "Hey, by the way, have you ever thought about being a recruiter? Because you've got a perfect personality and sort of behavioral makeup for that." Thought it never occurred to me, but she had just landed Merrill Lynch as a client and she knew nothing about the world of finance. And I was, of course, coming off of a 7 or 8 year career in finance. So we made an agreement. I would move to Santa Barbara. She would teach me everything about the world of recruiting and I would teach her about the world of finance. And so started working with Merrill Lynch, and basically it was trial by fire. I just jumped in, and in the first, I think it was 18 months, I closed 30 searches, which is an ungodly number of searches when you're just starting green out of some other industry. But really learned the business quickly, and then convinced my cousin to let me kind of come back to the Bay Area. I opened up a satellite office for her and did that for a few years until I was ready for kind of the next transition, which is the sort of the tumor experience that I was talking with you about.
Yes, and it's a really fascinating story. Before we get into it, I'm kind of fascinated by the fact that you grew up in such a laid-back community, and yet everything that you've shared points to a man with a high drive, ambition. How did that come about? Is that family of origin influence? Where did that originate from?
You know, it's a really good question. No one's ever asked me that. And as I'm just kind of sitting here pondering that, it may have been pushback from my childhood experience, because I grew up with in a very lower middle class kind of environment. My dad was a mailman. My mom was a cannery worker. So there was no real role model for business or success or finance or anything like that. My dad was also an alcoholic. And so I had a very difficult time growing up as a child, because if you've ever grown up with an alcoholic, sometimes they are super nice, calm, and reasonable, and then sometimes they're the exact opposite. And, you know, I didn't have an alcoholic father who was abusive physically or anything like that, but he was I'd call it verbally abusive. A lot of criticisms, a lot of name-calling, a lot of stuff like that, and I was a super sensitive kid, so I just kind of took that on personally, and I just knew I needed to run as far and as fast as I could away from my childhood experience. And so I think for me, it was probably, let me go get a college degree. My older brother was the first one to ever get a college degree in our family. I was the second one. And from there, fortunately, I had this mentor, Lynn Morris, who was kind of like a surrogate dad for me in my 20s. I mean, I'm realizing as I look back that he kind of fulfilled a lot of the interactions that I would have liked to have had with my dad. I got to have those with my mentor, Lynn, in my 20s. And so I think it really helped me to grow up and mature faster. And he was so wicked smart and so good at business. I think I just started to kind of pursue that, thinking, okay, that's the direction I need to go in.
The career that you chose requires a lot of organizational skills. And, you know, hearing that you grew up in a relatively chaotic environment, it must have, you know, it often happens that when you have a model like that, for lack of a better term, then you either go and repeat the pattern, so you go the exact opposite direction. And that's what it sounds like you chose.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because my dad died back in, let me just get the year, in 1991, so almost 30 years ago. And I was engaged at the time, and I was really kind of struggling in relationship. And so when he died, it really kind of pushed me over the edge, and I realized, you know, I really need some help here. I don't really feel like I've got a good understanding on the inside of who I am. And I think this is what really propelled my interest in personal growth and spiritual development and all that. And I did something that is probably the greatest gift I ever gave myself. And that was, I went and did an 8-day intensive called the Hoffman Process. They've got a site here in Napa, and they've got some other in the Napa Valley. They've got some sites all around the world. And it was created by a guy named Bob Hoffman. And one of the things that happened for Bob is one day, I don't really know what his background was. I don't know if he was a psychiatrist or psychologist or something like that. But he literally had like almost like a channeling experience where this whole program came through him, and he jotted down the structure of what the program was going to be. But it was based on the recognition that as a human being, we have four aspects of ourself. We have a spiritual self, a mental self, an emotional self, and a physical self. And when we're young children, typically ages 0 to 6, there's really only one thing that we all need that almost none of us get enough of, and that's unconditional love and acceptance from our caregivers, usually our parents. What we unconsciously do, because until age 6, we don't really have a conscious mind that's formed yet. So what we do unconsciously is what you just described. We either take on the traits and the beliefs and the behaviors of our parents, where the unconscious message that we're sending to them is, hey, look, mom and dad, I'm just like you, now will you love me? Or we do the rebellion thing where we do the exact opposite of who they are, where it's almost like a unconscious form of punishment, where it's like, I'm so freaking mad at you, I'm going to be the exact opposite of you just to piss you off kind of a thing. And some people do both. So you get into these weird unconscious push-pull behaviors where sometimes you're like your parents, sometimes you're not. And it creates a lot of confusion in our adult lives. And so I just knew I needed help with that. So the Hoffman process helped me really sort that out. And that set my life on just a completely different trajectory. So that's where a lot of the self-awareness came from. And like I said, it then set me on a new path of spiritual development.
It's really fascinating how, you know, the die is cast so early on in our life, and it takes a conscious effort and that level of awareness that you're referencing to really essentially reset the pace and to ask yourself those, you know, all important questions. And you brought up earlier, you said that engineering or, you know, this world was not my tribe. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you somehow knew that and you validated that by not pursuing it. Mm-hmm. That's quite instructive, because a lot of people wind up just moving along the pathway that's before them. And sometimes they question it later on in life, hence midlife crisis, I suppose. But they just don't give themselves permission to do this. And you have.
Yeah, but I tell you, it was not easy. I mean, I would say the first 30 years of my life were ridiculously difficult. Lots of pain, lots of suffering, lots of confusion, lots of wandering and questioning who am I and what am I doing and all that. It was not like I had a role model to guide that. Yeah. It was almost like an anti-role model. I was forced to do it because of all that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's funny because, you know, here I am in my mid-50s and I'm at a place where I can now look back over my entire life and realize at some level I believe my soul chose this life path, chose those parents, because whatever the experiences or the lessons that this soul needed to learn in this lifetime had to happen through those experiences. And I wouldn't have the self-awareness and the courage to have done some of the things I've done in the last 10 years if I hadn't had those formative experiences in my childhood and adolescence and all that. It's almost like you know, you develop your spiritual muscles the same way you do your physical muscles. You have to keep working out. You have to keep on, you know, pushing against resistance. And I realized that all of those resistance experiences in my childhood were basically forming my new spiritual muscles so that I would go on to become, you know, somebody very different than what I started out to be. But they were a critical part of the process. It's like if you've ever seen these domino arrays where they push one domino and that leads to 2 and then 6 and then 24, mm-hmm. and you've got this massive, colorized, beautiful display of dominoes. I kind of see my life when I look historically backwards as this array of dominoes that I could have never forecasted. And where I am sitting here today is I know there's a bunch of dominoes lined out in front of me and they're all about to tip over to touch a new set of dominoes, but I don't know what the array is going to look like going forward, but I can trust that every single domino that has fallen has led to the next right domino and the next right domino and the next right domino. They've led me to where I am right now, and I can just trust that, okay, it's going to open up into something really cool. All I have to do is surrender to it, not try and outthink it, not try and outplan it, manipulate it, control it. Just trust that there is a bigger plan that's going on here, and I just got to let go and open up to it.
That's really an elevated way of looking at the world, and very comforting, might I add, if you're not trying to impose your own will, but rather just surrender.
Yeah, can I talk about a book at this point?
Of course.
There is a book that totally changed my world about 2 years ago. It's called The Surrender Experiment. written by a guy named Michael A. Singer.
Okay.
And Michael tells a story of his life where he realized inside of our head we all have a voice that's talking to us all the time, whether we're aware of it or not. And it's typically judging the people and the experiences that are happening in our life. It's also regretting the things that have happened in the past, and it's fearing the things that might happen in the future. And so we're constantly engaged in this inner dialogue, and we get to the place where we believe that who we are is this little conversation going on inside of our heads. And so what he realized in his early 20s is that the spiritual traditions of the Far East and India and things like Zen Buddhism and whatnot, they've known about this voice for thousands of years, and all their spiritual traditions are based at discovering that that voice and that conversation in your head is not who you are. There's something much larger than that experience that's really who you really are. And so he trained himself to stop listening to that voice, because that voice was always telling things like, you should like this person and hang out with them. You should not like that person, not want to hang out with them. You should not pursue this career. You should not do this. You should not do that. And he realized that 50% of the time that inner voice was sort of setting him up for pleasurable experiences, and the other 50% it was setting him up for really negative, painful experiences. And one day he realized, you know, the universe is something like 13.8 billion years old. There's some kind of an intelligence that has been guiding the creation and the unfolding of all these billions of galaxies out there. We happen to live in one of those galaxies called the Milky Way, and we happen to be on this little speck of dirt called the Earth that's orbiting around this star called the Sun. And even though my little ego mind inside of my head is constantly telling me what I should and shouldn't do, on any given day, that intelligence of the universe never comes to my little ego mind to ask what it should create next. Instead, it just keeps putting stuff in front of me. And so he trained himself to stop listening to the inner voice and literally to just pay attention to what's showing up in front of me each day and say yes to that, even if the little voice on the inside said, no, don't do that. So I've started embracing this in the last couple of years, and it's just rocked my world. It's not easy. It's something that takes a lot of practice and a lot of courage and willingness to like stop listening to that voice, because we know that voice is just inundating us all the time. So I'm doing a lot more of the surrender. That's what I was talking about with the dominoes. I've learned how to surrender and trust the next array of dominoes that are going to be displayed are being guided by some kind of intelligence that's way smarter than my little pea brain, you know, sort of ego mind.
That's quite a...
Isn't that cool?
Yes.
I love it.
I'm a bit awestruck. I'm obviously going to run out and get the book. It's so fascinating because I've always believed that what's happening between the ears is really the major force in our world, if not, you know, the defining. And it's one thing to be aware of, it's nothing to do something about it. And it sounds like you actively pursued separating and maybe even divorcing yourself from that voice. That's not all that helpful.
Yeah, absolutely.
We spoke about you being exceptionally successful in the recruiting world, that you kind of took it by storm, and then something happened. You mentioned the physical challenge that you had to overcome, and that took you in a different direction. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so, you know, it's funny, just to kind of clarify what you just said there. So where I am today, I'd say feels very successful.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started out recruiting, did not feel successful. I was still kind of wrestling with my baggage from my childhood experience with my dad and all that.
Got it.
But over the last 20 years, that stuff has really started to sort of settle down and work its way through. But so I mentioned that, you know, my cousin, I started recruiting with her, and initially it was in financial services. So I went on to work with some of the big mutual fund companies as an outside recruiter for T. Rowe Price and Fidelity and some of the big banks in Boston and New York and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And along the way, back in like 1997, I'd been a big runner. And when I go for a long, you know, run, usually I felt great for, you know, the next few days. But all of a sudden I started to notice this very painful, dull ache in my low back when I'd come back from a run.
Mm.
And it got worse and worse and worse. And ultimately I discovered a chiropractor in Mill Valley. This guy has saved my life, named Dr. Alan Creed. He now lives in Florida. But he had a diplomate degree in neurology, which is like a PhD in the nervous system. So when I met with him to describe this pain I was having, he did like a 2-hour intake session to really kind of understand what's going on. He said, you know, there's something in your body. I don't know what it is, but we need to do an x-ray. So they did an x-ray. He couldn't really see anything, but his intuition told him there was something going on. So he had six of his best friends who were x-ray specialists review the x-rays. They all told him he was crazy, didn't know what he was talking about. There was nothing in there. He still trusts his intuition. They did an MRI scan and found I had a tumor the size of a tennis ball in my sacrum bone.
Wow.
My fiance, we had just gotten engaged. We postponed our wedding. We put basically a reach out to everybody in our network. Hey, who should we be talking to? And this same name came back six times, Dr. Jim Johnston. He was something like the granddaddy of spinal bone tumor surgery at UCSF. And so we met with him. He took one look at the scan. He turned around to Colleen and I, and he said, I don't know how you guys found me, but you are so lucky because I'm one of maybe five guys in the world who's ever seen this tumor. And I'm happy to report it was misdiagnosed. It's not spinal bone cancer. It's actually a benign tumor. It's been growing in your body since you were in your mom's womb. And the way I know that is someplace on your body you have a cafe au lait spot. And I kind of did this like, a what? I thought I misunderstood some kind of medical terminology. He said, you have a cafe au lait spot. You know, if you spill a cafe au lait on a white tablecloth, you'll see a brown spot. Where on your body do you have one of those? And sure enough, on the inside of my left thigh, I had one. I dropped my drawers and showed him. He goes, yep, that's it. Because the reason I know you have that, and the reason I know this is a neurolymphoma tumor, is that the same tissue that forms the spine when you're in mother's womb goes on to form the skin, you know, sort of later in your development mm-hmm. process. So we found like a 96% correlation with these spots on a person's skin. Tells us that somewhere from about age 35 to 50, they're going to have one to five of these benign tumors start to show up along their spine, and sure enough, you've got one. So anyway, it's large, slow growth. You don't have to do surgery right now, but at some point you will, because if it keeps on growing, which it will, you'll probably just wake up paralyzed from the waist down at some point.
Oh my God.
So we freaked out and walked out of there, and I thought, you know, I've heard so many stories about the risk of back surgery. Let me do some online research. So I read a bunch of studies and found that it's kind of a crapshoot. Sometimes the surgery is successful, sometimes it's not. But anytime they open up your back, you potentially introduce yourself to some huge risks and issues. And so I decided I want to try some alternative approaches before I agree to do surgery. And so as part of my spiritual evolution and all my explorations I was doing, I started working with every possible kind of alternative practitioner you can imagine. As I said, my fiance at that point was a medical hypnotherapist, and medical hypnotherapy looks at the mind-body connection. And a lot of times what they've discovered is that a lot of illnesses and diseases can be traced to trauma that happened in your early childhood that was never healed. And so I thought, well, God, maybe there was something with my, you know, my upbringing with my dad that may have set this thing off. But anyway, I worked with shamans, I worked with Chinese acupuncturists, Chinese herb specialists, I did everything you could imagine, meditation and whatnot. And ultimately, after a year, it hadn't shrunk. And I had an epiphany, what I call a spiritual awakening. And I realized, you know, people talk about the presence of this intelligence of the universe being in everything, or as some people might call it God or spirit or the divine or whatever. And I realized, you know, if that energy, that force is present in everything, then it's got to be present in the hand of the surgeon and that scalpel also. So whatever fear I've had about having surgery, I've got to let go of that and trust that this is on my path. This is what I'm supposed to do next. So head surgery. They discovered it was in such a risky area of the spine that they actually had to sever the S1 nerve to get the tumor out. So I was left with complete muscle atrophy in my right calf. So for the last 22 years, I had surgery in February of 1997. I walked with a little bit of a limp because I don't have any calf muscle in my right calf. But the alternative to spinal bone cancer or something like that was like, it's like, man, I'm so glad I found this guy. And so anyway, when I was healing from surgery, I started meditating a lot. And it was during meditation that I found myself asking the question, when I'm healthy again, I want to be doing something I'm really passionate about. What is that? And what came back, after I'd say probably 2 or 3 months of no answer, but I kept asking the question, one day this little voice on the inside chimed in and said, red wine. And I sort of shockingly was wondering, like, what was that and where did that come from? You know, the next day I did the same thing, and sure enough, the voice came back. And I began to realize this voice on the inside, it was like a pit bull that had me by the ankle, was not going to let go. And I had another little epiphany when I realized, you know, this must be one of those experiences that people sometimes talk about where you have to learn to listen to and hear that inner voice. If you're really grounded, if you're really in a spiritual place, that voice will be speaking truth, and you need to hear it and honor it and trust it and take action on it. And so ultimately I just said, all right, I'm going to trust that that's what this is that's happening, and I'm going to pursue figuring out how to break into wine. So I'm at the point, at that point, when I was finally healthy again, it took another 10 months before that happened. I met with a guy who was the top recruiter in the wine industry, and I walked in with my resume and told my story. Look, I've got this background in finance and also executive search, but I've got a real passion for wine. And what had happened on wine, how I got interested in wine is, the last couple of years when I was consulting, I was on a long-term assignment in the Southeast, working for what was then the early stages of what we now call cellular phones. They used to call it, it was actually called SMR. I can't remember what it stands for, but it was the early days of wireless telecom. And I worked for a startup company that was building a network across 14 states in the Southeast. And the CFO just happened to be a wine collector. And so living in San Francisco area, I would fly to the Southeast. And they were initially in Greenville, South Carolina. Then they were Atlanta, Georgia. And I'd stay for a week or two at a time. And so when I go down there for the weekends, he and his wife would feel sorry for me having to hole up in a hotel over the weekend, so they'd invite me to dinner. And so every time I go to dinner, he'd take me down to his cellar and talk to me about wines, and I just got fascinated by the wines of France and Spain and Italy and whatnot, and so developed a palate and an interest in wine. So that's probably where this inner voice was able to sort of say to me, you know, you need to pursue a career in wine. There's something passion. There's some kind of passion deep in there that you've never tapped into. So anyway, the recruiter basically looked at my resume, threw it back in my chest, and laughed at me and said, kid, I can't help you, you know, break into wine. You don't have a background in wine. What am I supposed to do with you? Why don't you go and build your wine cellar and read Wine Spectator? And I kind of walked out very dejected and kicking the dirt. And then within a day or two, I thought, you know, that was a really unnecessary way to handle that situation. I'm going to actually redouble my efforts and figure out how to break into wine. So I put the word out to everybody I knew. If you know anybody who's in wine, I'd like to talk to him, see if I can find a way in. And ultimately, one of my friends had a brother who had just become the president of a winery down in Monterey called Smith & Hook, owned by a guy named Nicky Hahn, who's a billionaire from Switzerland, and he owned thousands of acres of vineyards down there. And so Bill Leegan is the guy's name, had become president. And when he got in there, what he realized is that his controller would close out the financial books at the end of each month, ship the financials off to the CPA and Salinas, and 3 months later, Bill would get his income statement and balance sheet and cash flow reports. Well, if you're running a wine business, you cannot make decisions based on three-month-old financial data. You need that data to be current, you know, as of today. And so he asked if I could build an Excel model that would help him to plan the business, plan out sales projections for 5 years, tie that together with their production schedules, tie that together with their vineyard yield projections. And so I had never built a model like that, but of course I told him, yeah, of course I can do that, Bill. So I just completely, you know, sort of, what's the word for it?
Fake it till you make it.
Yeah, fake it till you make it. That's exactly what I did. So anyway, that's how I learned the wine business. I dug in and I got to see every moving part of the business. And so 10 months in, I was just about done. I got a call completely out of the blue from Pete Madavi Jr. at Charles Krug Winery. And he knew a former recruiting colleague of mine, and he was sitting on the selection committee for the new dean of the engineering school at Stanford. And he asked my old buddy, David Belshaw, do you know anybody who's a recruiter in the wine industry? And David said, well, you know, my old recruiting colleague, David Newland, just started working in wine. He's a great recruiter. You know, maybe you want to call him. So Pete called and said, hey, here's the deal. We are stuck selling about 500,000 cases a year. We can't figure out how to sell our product in the grocery channel. Now, keep in mind, this is back in 2001, 2002. The only wineries that were effectively selling in the grocery channel were Gallo and Constellation and the Wine Group, the three biggies. The Mondavi family at Charles Krug, they hadn't figured out how to crack that code yet. So Pete asked if I'd take on a search and go find a new national sales manager for them. And I said, Pete, I don't think you understand. I don't have an existing network in the wine industry yet. And he stopped me dead in my tracks. He said, no, I don't think you understand. We don't want somebody from the wine industry. We've worked with all the existing recruiters, and they're old school. They have this like database of resumes they keep sort of retreading over and over again. We need somebody to go out and find a national sales manager in, let's say, consumer packaged goods, who wants to learn about wine. We'll teach them everything about wine if they'll teach us how to sell in the grocery channel. So I took the search on. I found a woman who was living here in Napa named Karen Hunt. She had worked for Ben & Jerry's, Mars, M&M's, a candy bar company, a couple of other consumer packaged goods companies. She'd been trying to break into wine for 3 years, and she'd never found a job that was at a senior enough level. So I got her placed at Charles Krug. And in the next 4 years, she took them from 500,000 cases to 1.2 million cases.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.